Hey, Jimmy.
Hey, Angela.
This is Books Are Good, actually.
And we are good at that.
We're super good at that now. All right. So for this month of August, we read The Long 20th Century. And by read, I mean halfway read, because boy, howdy, that book was dense.
Halfway read. Quarter read.
Quarter read. Okay.
Yes.
Before we get into it, I want to make a correction, and this has been weighing heavily on my mind. So, in last episode, I mentioned, wow, Korra had 26 episodes in season 2 or 3, and that's not true. I got tricked by the stupid CBS interactive TV, whatever. They had the behind-the-scenes stuff, and I was like, oh, that's why they added all these episodes, because they just did that. So I'm sorry if I got anyone's hopes up that there's more episodes of Korra than there really was. And now it's on Netflix, so I spent $10 for on fucking nothing. So that was cool.
And this goes to show you, kids, steal your media, always.
I'll say you should steal anime media, always. But because that is always a clusterfuck, and Crunchyroll are not good people, so... you know, do what you need to do, I guess.
Yep. If you don't have the capital to consume things in a manner in which it's not going to affect you in your long-term livelihood, consume it however you like, because you don't have the capital to spend on it in the first place.
Anyway, back to this book, The Long 20th Century, by Giovanni Arrighi. I think I got that
Arrighi.
Name. Arrighi, excuse me. This book is pretty academic. There's a lot of sources, which is great. But the question is, who is this book for? And I'm bringing up the question I put last on our notes first, but I think maybe it's worth discussing right now.
Yes. Before our excuses for not finishing?
Yes.
Okay. All right. So I would say that this book is for anyone who is interested in a really deep dive into the history and the behavior that capital and capitalism exhibited as it grew and took form. It's, as Angela can better attest than I, it's incredibly dense. It's very detailed. It would make a fantastic book for any late world history college course, either undergraduate or graduate. It is not easy fare.
No, it's really not. You can definitely read the introduction and probably the first chapter and get a sense of what it is.
Yes.
And this is definitely a political science book. It has charts and graphs about, and a theory that's trying to prove.
I wish that I saw those charts and graphs, but,
they're very few and far between. So I don't think they would help you all that much.
Oh, also that, the version that I read, because I consume my media in non-capital taking ways, did not have those. Also, it had lots of bizarre symbols in place of words.
Oh, I had that problem too. I had the FLs and THs. When I was copying and pasting some things from it from my notes, I noticed that. That's why the Kindle just left them out, because they were just weird characters. I don't know why. I think it's probably the DRM that's on the book, most likely.
Yeah. So it was also sometimes just confusing to read for that. Just like, okay, I know this is a term like that I should like either Google or search in some way, but I can't figure out what it's supposed to be saying, because it is a mash of symbols.
Yeah, there's when I first initially read it, I didn't know which symbol or which letters were taken out. So I saw high Nanchul, and I was like, what the fuck is Nanchul? And it took me like a couple of pages later, like, oh, financial. Okay, this makes more sense now.
One that jumps out at me is Bauta Finance. And yes. I was like, Bau to Finance? Okay, what is Bau to Finance? Let's search that. And it was Haute Finance for I guess the French for high finance.
I guess so. That makes some sense.
Anyway, besides us having issues just reading the book itself due to the nature in which we were reading it, it's real dense.
Yeah, and I think if you really want a deep dive, it's good for that. It goes through the history. It's not just like, here's some historical figures and like what they did, and thus they're the ones who create the system. It's more of an abstract way of saying, okay, for instance, the Italian system and how they went from products to trading products and goods to speculating, and kind of like, how did, you know, the Genovese system kind of be a thing, and not really like this one person did it all, really. It's more like, yeah, just because of these certain circumstances, that's what the system turned out to be. And that's, you know, if you look at it, this is capitalism. Came up with
it is very like abstract in that sense, but it is also very concrete at the same time. Like a lot of history courses will talk about how the Black Death led to a rise in power for the laboring class of the time, the proletariat. But Arrighi also puts forth that prior to just about the same time as the Black Death really becoming a craze across the continent, the Florentine were investing, was it the Florentine or the Genoese who were investing in, it was the Florentine because they were the wool people, but they had invested really heavily in the Kingdom of England. And England had, as a part of getting the investments, gone to war with France. And then 2 years into the Hundred Years' War with France, defaulted on their loans completely, resulting in a complete crash of the financial system of Florence and generally of the other city-state markets of Italy at the time, who were basically all tied together because they each specialized in one commodity, which together made them strong because they were able to actually specialize rather than just compete in like the more like cutthroat manner of like, I'm gonna like drive down my prices on this to cut you out of the market. Instead, it's I'm going to raise my prices by making a finer product because you're not making it. But it is really specific, but also really abstract.
Right.
Going to what you were saying about cycles, yeah, he really lays it all out in the whole book in very, like, really solid overview in the prelude and the first chapter.
I thought it was interesting that the introduction was very, like, it was, like, it's 20 pages, and usually with introductions, I'm kind of used to, like, a 5-page, and, like, okay, we're going to get into it, but he was, like, no, I'm trying to answer this question. These are some of the other authors that have gone through the same exercise before, so let's take it a step further.
These are the ways that they talked about it. These are the things that I found lacking. It is very academic. It is not intended for like the pop psych or pop history crowd.
Yeah, for sure. This is definitely a book that you should take it slowly and piece by piece, and like really think about what like each section is telling you. Because I did it like section for section because I couldn't. A chapter is like 60 pages long, and sitting trying to read it all in one sitting was just not a good idea.
But the first chapter and the prelude, they hit on all of the big notes. And he, so the rest of the book, once again, I didn't read it all. You read more than me. But he lays it out in the first chapter and the prelude that it's discussing the cycles of capital and how they jumped from form to form to form in place to place. And so it started with Venetians and then went to the Dutch and then the English and then the US. And then he finishes off with speculation on who it's going to be next, which, as we know now, given the time frame in which he was writing this, some of his estimates are off.
He knew it was going to be some Asian country. He thought it was going to be Japan, because this was written in 1994, and Japan was always the one country people were like, well, they're eventually going to overtake the United States. And then it turned out, it was going to be China.
Mm-hmm. Maybe.
Well,
yeah. I'm very much in the corner of his final guess, which is it's just going to be chaos for a while and nobody's going to come out on top until something else happens.
Yeah, that's fair enough. I shouldn't have said it's going to be China, but it mm-hmm. became more apparent that China right now, compared to Japan, is, you can see, that could be the next seat of capital. Like, if there's if his theory is correct and it was going to be some Asian country,
mm-hmm.
He was thinking Japan, but it's most likely China if, you know,
if there was going to be anyone in that section of the world. Totally agree. Something else that jumped out at me regarding that is in the book, he talks about how at the beginning of capitalism is subsumed within the state, subsumed within the Venetian state. And by the point in which we're currently living, the state that is hegemonic, the U.S., is subsumed by capitalism in that it's so many of these companies are essentially out of the grasp of the state. They can exist and operate extra spatially, essentially, in that they function with their headquarters here in the U.S. or wherever abroad. They're not subject to taxation in the way that they should be because of how they are managing their finance on a international scale. And it jumped out at me while I was thinking about that not only does he lay out the cycles for capital between the commoditization and then the financialization for each period and the territory money territory prime and then the money territory money prime chain, looks really nice when you start to like really expand it out as a nice little series of steps. But it may well be the case that it could well be China, because what if the cycle is for capital to go from subsumed by the state to subsuming the state back to being subsumed by the state.
So essentially having the government control the
system of capital. Yes.
Yeah.
And China is not communist. China is a state capitalist run country. And that could well be the case that they are the hegemonic next step because they are the next step in that swing. That's just me spitballing. I'm not a fan of China. Well, I'm not a fan of state authority in any form, which China is very state authoritarian. So China and me have beef, but the U.S. and me have beef. Every state and me have beef.
So the thing with China, probably being the next long whatever. I don't know, long 21st century, I guess. They're doing the same steps that, for instance, the Genovese. I wasn't sure because of the missing words. I was like, shit, what if I'm missing part of this country's name? And I'm just like, it's Genoa. And then it's like Genovese. But anyway, so usually the steps are you go from trade, like trading products and goods, to you pretty much start profits start going up and then they decrease. So then you start going into, I think the next step was territorial expansion.
If you could. So like the Genovese were city states with Florence and Venice and Milan. And they also had to deal with like papal issues, which
they also didn't really have like a standing. Yeah. Sorry.
Listeners can go back to a prior episode and hear all about all the fun papal issues.
They also didn't really have I don't think each state, they all pretty much all had mercenaries, right? They didn't really have a standing army.
Yes.
I think
Rome
pretty much had the standing army, right?
Well, if you remember, sort of, but not really. Like, they were very much dependent on being able to hire other armies, as we saw with the papacy at one point hiring the Germans.
Right.
I think around this time.
Yeah,
maybe a little earlier.
Yeah, it's around this time. This was, that sounds about right.
But the Genoese were not in the position to make the territorial expansion that would have allowed them to continue the chain. The chain being TM, T prime, and then that M that they use for the team prime becoming M, T prime, M prime, and then so on and so forth. And the Dutch were able to a little bit with the like port of calls that they established, but it was the British that really did it in a way that nobody had done before.
Right.
And I don't know that China can do that.
So I feel like, I think China can kind of do that because they're kind of doing that with Africa. They're expanding into there. They're making partnerships with them.
Yes. Yes.
That's why I'm like, well, that's kind of following the same pattern.
I feel like that's following in our pattern of dealing with decolonized countries, where the U.S. did a lot of like IMF and World Bank, like, we'll invest in you and then you need to follow our rules. And China is doing very similar. Because they're finding places for their capital to work, because they are both, I feel like this step in the chain is the next like stepping point, because going from Dutch to British, the change in how capital functioned was the British were able to territorialize in a way that the Dutch couldn't. Because the British didn't have to deal with land wars and being invaded and having to defend themselves. It was an island. And then the U.S. didn't have to deal with that because they were pretty isolationist and were able to do territorial expansion internally. I say internally, but it was external westward expansion and southward expansion.
Yeah, and any colonial powers that were there just didn't have like the rate of which information getting back, like, oh hey, we need some additional like support, was just it just wasn't possible, like, fast enough for them to really respond all that much. Also, we just had more people to be like, hey, we're just gonna shove a bunch of dudes at this one fort until they just die, and then we'll just be like, it's ours now.
And on top of that, they had other territories to deal with, on top of also having to deal with continental politics of Europe and continental warcraft of Europe. China is has attempted to do some expansion territorially. I mean, they are trying to take control of the South China Sea. They have pushed into Tibet. But I can't see them having with the military buildup that we have currently. By we, I mean the world. So many countries having nukes, so many countries having sophisticated intelligence systems and sophisticated like long-range weaponry.
Also, we're buying all of our stuff from each other. Like, mm-hmm. If you think, we build all of our systems from the US, that's probably partially true. But there's probably little pieces, like a screw or some shit, that just comes from China or Germany or wherever.
Mm-hmm. So I can't see them being able to territorialize in the same way that, say, Britain was able to, or even the US did, in the sense of, like, I can't see them expanding just westward from where they are right now. And I also feel like they're skipping the step of commoditizing and then financializing. Well, sort of. I feel like they commoditized for like 20 or 30 years, and they are still commoditizing now, but they are also financializing now, and they're doing both.
Yeah, they are. Yeah, I would say that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. So I think that would be the next step, in that you were able to fully subsume both phases at the same time and provide stability through being able to do both, in a way where doing only one at any time leads to your ascent and then your descent. But that, I'm just spitballing now.
Yeah. So part of the book, and I thought, like, initially this was going to always be the case, he mentions that essentially the Genovese system would go on, there was a big crisis, and then at that point the Dutch system was kind of going, and it, as Genovese kind of wound down or crashed, the Dutch system kind of went off, and then eventually that kind of crashed. And mm-hmm. it seemed like with the British system and eventually the U.S. system, which I didn't really read into, but mm-hmm. if you just kind of look at the Great Depression or any other financial crisis, that didn't really upset the, you know, global economic power. Mm-hmm. Because he mentions in the British section that there was a, there apparently was a myth of a depression, but he provided examples of, yeah, there was a depression, and there was also record profits at the same time.
That sounds familiar.
Yeah. So
it's very.
So that didn't, because of that happened, that didn't mean that, the United States finally overtook Britain. Like, eventually that did happen, but it wasn't because of this depression that occurred.
Yeah.
It just happened later due to probably pretty much the United States kind of opening up their shit.
And also World War I and World War II.
Yeah, pretty much the wars, yeah.
Draining so many resources from Britain and really stressing their ability to hold the Indian subcontinent.
Yeah, because he mentioned the Napoleonic Wars, which I'll admit, I kind of, sounds really stupid, but I didn't realize how close to the Napoleonic Wars were to like World War One. I thought Napoleon was like late 1700s, mm-hmm. when really it was more like early mid 1800s. And I'm like, mm-hmm. Okay, well, that makes more sense since now. Mm-hmm. Why mm-hmm. a lot of these, we got a lot of weird like political systems kind of just hanging around, and then why people are like, yeah, let's go to war, let's do World War I, sounds great.
Yeah the Napoleon is always, and this is maybe furthering my inability to fully grasp all of history all at once, but Napoleon's always stuck out as that, like, I don't know when you are, like, I don't know how long you were, I know you happened, I know, like, you rose and fell. I know that you were, because of you, we have canned food. But I cannot put you in time. And it's crazy to me to think about, like, okay, Napoleon is happening. And then the Civil War?
Yeah.
And Marx existed through all of this?
Exactly. So so he kind of posits that just because there's a crisis, going back to the crisis stuff real quick, that pretty much most, I think at this point right now, most big, like the global economic powers can kind of survive a crisis. And we kind of saw this, like 2008 and right now. Nothing has, like, you know, up, like, oh, United States, they're out. You know, we don't know. We're not going to know until who the fuck knows.
I have a feeling it's just a guess, just a poorly informed guess, but I have a feeling it is going to result, the next tumultuous change, it's going to result in what all the Posadists want. Somebody's going to launch nukes. And that's going to be the thing that finally tips things over, because in the current state of things, like, even with our terribly, horribly, viciously mismanaged government as we currently have, I can't see anything tipping the apple cart over. Outside of that.
Yeah, I mean, unless someone, like, yeah, I guess it pretty much has to be a very drastic tragedy or something to really kind of make things worse. Because you have to, like, I guess we have to kind of understand, too, from a historical context, like, right now, despite everything going on, it's relatively peaceful.
Yeah.
And so there's not a whole lot of, you know, like when we read People's History, there were kind of this ongoing tension for like hundreds of years that was always about to like pop off at any moment.
Mm-hmm.
And that was also the case. He mentioned Giovanni in the book, like there was a lot of, especially with the Dutch, there was a lot of like labor, but there was also, because of that too, there was a lot of these labor disputes that always fucking occur. Because they had all these dudes just hanging out, doing all this work. But then once profits start going up and wages start going depressed, then people started fucking rebelling. But, you know, at that point, the thing is, like, we don't really, except for, like, a minority, we don't have a whole lot of people going around trying to find work than, like, you know, 400 years ago.
Yeah, we definitely do not have the visible human migrations that go with a depression or a recession. And it really does not create the same. I'm sure it does in some sense, like, but the suffering is so large, but also so widespread that it's easily subsumed into the system, even as the system is faltering.
Yeah.
I'm also, like, going back to your point of, like, we're at one of the most peaceful times that we've ever seen. I can't see, and this may be speaking to my ignorance regarding the politics of each of these continents, but I can't see Europe or South America or Africa or Asia really engaging in a continent-sized war in the same way that, say, Europe did basically from the 1400s to, like, 1945.
Yeah, 'cause we just don't have, or Europe just had a bunch of weird-ass, like, squabbles about land and who owns what and That's a very, very, like, basic thing that I've known. Also playing Crusader Kings, where someone's like, the so-and-so's birthright is here, and someone else is like, hi, I'm the cousin, so no, it's mine, and whatever. And you're like, okay, I guess we gotta fight about it. Or someone gonna stick up their ass and be like, you know what, I wanna have this island. So now we're going to get this fucking island. And you're like, okay, I guess. Like, we just don't have that anymore. Like, we can't, like, it's just not a thing that people really give that much of a shit about, or, like, at some point. However, if it's a religious reason, then that's just always gonna...
Yeah. That also reminded me of a bit out of the... I think it's the first chapter. It might have been the second chapter, but I think it was the first chapter where the CEO of Dow Chemical in like the 50s or 60s, and I'm paraphrasing really horribly here, basically said, my dream is to have like an island somewhere where I can declare Dow Chemical to be sovereign on that island and separate from every government, so that anywhere Dow is operating, our agents can act as citizens of that country, but not actually be dependent as citizens of that country. I don't know how to thread that in here, but it jumped out at me.
Yeah, that was an interesting comment. I just, I'm not... If it's from the 1950s, I'm not surprised. It's like, yeah, why don't we just have islands where we just do whatever the fuck we want? And then we'll just be like, oh, we're selling our product. We're the nation of Dow, and we export Dow chemical products. And everyone lives on our, who work there, live on this fucking island thing. I'm pretty sure there's a Venture Brothers episode about this.
Yeah. Yeah. That's basically Skull Island.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. There you go.
But yeah. I don't know if it's going to be China. If it is going to be China, it's going to... I feel like this century is going to take a while to become the long 21st century, because I don't feel like the U.S. is going to fall over in the same way that the previous hegemons did. Like, not to say that Britain fell over, but... I don't see us being dragged into a scenario where resources, well, I don't know. If we mishandle COVID for long enough.
I guess so, yeah. If we just kept fucking around and finding out with COVID, yeah, I guess eventually would just kind of be like, well, here you go. Like, we're kind of just all, half our population's gone.
Yeah. If we end up accidentally wiping out like large swaths of our military bases, and we end up wiping out large swaths of the population who is still employed right now and capable of making purchases in a manner that will continue to keep the national economy chugging along, we're gonna find out.
Yeah. I just had a thought, which is going to be nearly impossible because we just cannot get our act together. What if we actually just start expanding into space and actually start having space colonies?
Yes, that is the new tea. I was thinking about that as well. Yeah.
Because, I mean, if we were like, okay, like, we're all about to nuke each other. Why don't we just all just go into space with our fucking space colonies? Promise to not drop it on, you know, on each other. It'll be dope. We're going to have a lottery system because, of course, we would, because we need a means test everything to go into space. Mm-hmm. And, yeah, we just, send 100 people up into space, and then we have a weird prison, a weird space prison thing,
Just going into Gundam.
Yeah, also I was going to the 100 and be like, yeah, and then we nuke Earth and then, like, we send 100. Okay, anyway.
But, yeah, no, that definitely did cross my mind that was one way where China would be able to create the TMT MTM Prime, et cetera, chain that is really necessary to becoming a hegemon in a way that wouldn't necessarily require them to engage in territorial expansion on Earth. Because as far as territory goes, they've got a lot of it. Like,
yep.
They are definitely mineral rich. They are resource rich in a variety of ways. They have also the means to create commodities to bring in capital that normally a lot of mineral rich or commodity rich countries don't. And that would be a way for them to deal with the expansionist portion of the chain that is required to really grow into the hegemony that I'm sure they definitely want to be.
Yeah. I can see them being like, okay, so we've expanded enough into Africa. Which I know they have a fuck ton of mines, and let's use all that resources to just go into space, and let's just try to be, oh, okay, if you want to go into space and have stuff, you need to get it from China. Like, you need to get these, like, products or these resources from China if you want to have your own colony or whatever.
Sure, yeah. I mean, if they're the first to really create space colonies in a reproducible way, that's it. That's the next point of capital, at least as far as if capital is going to continue and we're not going about to seize the means and really have the fun of figuring out which flavor of socialism or communism we want to enact in any particular place, which I'm sure will be its own bloodbath. I hope not, but that would be the way for them to be able to commoditize the fact that we're destroying the Earth and you want to leave, right?
Yep.
Give your capital to Space China.
Yeah, just go to Space China, and wow, we're going to expand to Mars really soon, and we'll have things there. Yes, I've watched The Expanse, and I can see pretty much us being Expanse, except without the experimental and alien life forms. Because I don't know. I'm kind of in the three-part body problem where aliens already contacted us and just were like, nah, we're not fucking with that.
Yeah.
We're just going to and blow us up. One of the two.
Any sufficiently intelligent like life form that exists outside of Earth that was able to discover Earth said no thanks real fast.
I guess, was there anything from your readings that kind of were like aha moments or moments where you're like, oh, I thought it was things were going to work out this way, but it turns out I would like my hypothesis was like wrong, because I thought that about the financial crises was kind of the like, that's okay, you know, financial crisis, you're it, you're done, there's no way to recover, someone else is going to do the thing now.
Mm-hmm. Like every page really like contained like something that was like, damn, what? But that may be due more to my lack of remembering my history courses. But then I also feel like my history courses weren't taught with this angle to capital in the same way. So it may be the case that I learned about these things, but they were divorced from the understanding of how capital was influencing and influenced them or influenced by them. So it was just like, oh, this thing happened, and then people revolted, and then this thing happened, and then people were happy, and blah, 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 blah. But then the thing, and I've mentioned it multiple times now, is the TMT prime, MT prime, M prime, T prime, M prime, T double prime, M prime, T double prime, M double prime chain, because Marx talks about MCM prime, and this reconfigures that concept from Marx into a way to really understand not just how capital functions in the moment, but how capital functions over time and over space.
Gotcha. So I haven't read any Marx. I've just
I haven't either.
Okay. So the thing is, like, when he started bringing in Marx's like theories and other, you know, equations in, I thought that was very interesting. However, it didn't, for me, didn't really help me all that much, because I didn't have a frame of reference of what Marx was going for. I kind of understood because I just based on reading other stuff or just the news or whatever, like, oh, okay, yeah, eventually accumulation, you just become, just go to infinite and then eventually you just kind of stop. So I was like, those, I can
or
understand.
You sue people to destroy them, like
yeah.
Peter Thiel and Gawker.
Yeah. But I thought that was good. I might, what kind of makes me want to go and read some Marx literature, even though I know that is probably just as dry. So.
Boy, howdy. Yeah. All I can tell you, having not read any Marx, but having listened to a lot of other people who have talked about their readings of Marx, I hope you're ready to learn about cloth.
Okay. I wish they just came out. Why can't they make a sieve, but for Marx? Like, just so you're like, okay, so we're going to talk about the shit. All right. Make it gamify me. I'm a millennial.
There sort of is. It's I picked up a game off Steam a couple years ago, and you can, it's more abstract than like Marx gets, as far as like here's how these things function. But I cannot remember the name. If you were to read any Marx, I would say immediately after, read, and once again, I have not read this. I've just listened to a bunch of people talk about it from a variety of perspectives. But Fanon's The Wretched of the Earth, which essentially flips Marx's discussions of the proletariat and the bourgeoisie and the lumpen proletariat, because in Marx's view of things, the lumpen proletariat is the reactionary force that has to be forced into revolution or coerced into revolution, whereas the proletariat is ripe for revolution. Fanon talks about decolonialization in a Marxist sense. But he makes clear that in a colonized country, the proletariat is the reactionary group because they are the group that is afforded luxuries and positions of status and power versus the lumpen proletariat. And it very interesting contrast on how to view ways to organize for struggle or listen to a bunch of podcasts and that'll save you time.
Yes, podcasts are fine, but I like experiencing a book, some, you know, as a thing. And like, for example, I actually read three of the Twilight books because people were like, yeah, it's not great. And I'm like, all right, you know what? I'm gonna fucking read it because I can read most not great stuff as a minor of fan fiction. You gotta kind of go and read a bunch of bad stuff before you're like, ah, this is bad, and then this is the good stuff. You got. You have to do it. You have to read the bad. So I read it, and I was like, it's okay. Like, I like vampires as a thing. As a former baby goth, vampires are dope. And I was like, this is an interesting interpretation of the vampires. And then that was it. I was like, So I'd rather just read Marx, and if I'm like, this is very boring or whatever, and then I'll probably go read or listen to a podcast.
Sure. Good luck. Let me know. Maybe we'll have to do like a little like mini arc of struggling through various Marx texts, but definitely not in the next 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 books.
Yeah.
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 Looking over our questions, I can't see anything we haven't covered so far. Origi has like 2 other books that go on to expand on what he covers in this book. The third one came out in 2007 and is called Adam Smith in Beijing. So I think he did eventually make the transition from viewing Japan as the next point of hegemony to China. But even then, I don't know whether he actually came down on the yes or no column for China being the next point of hegemony. But those exist. And if you decide to read this book, probably if you enjoy it, continue.
Yeah. So if there's nothing else, I guess we can just wrap up.
Yeah, yeah.
This is our first You Tried Gold Star episode.
I was thinking about like making a reference in the middle or at the beginning of this episode to the episode of Malcolm in the Middle, where Lois goes to the only book club meeting that she goes to and discovers that all of the moms in the book club don't actually read the book, because the entire purpose of the book club is for them to have a night off to drink wine with each other, that they can excuse to their families because their families wouldn't understand that they need time to just blow off some steam. And having a book club is a better excuse than I need to decompress from dealing with you. And I don't know. It's a good episode. It's sort of not to say that Origi was not enjoyable to read. What I read of it was enjoyable and interesting, but it was also not a good... Oh, we didn't do our excuses. Not a good month for reading extremely dense things. I struggle learned with Angela's help for about 2 weeks on how to and how not to get TLS certificates in place for a website. My company decided that it needed half as many people in my position. So my stress levels responded correspondingly.
It's just been a month and a year, so I just was like, this is a dense book and I'll get as far as I can, and got to like the fourth chapter and I was like, cool, this is the third chapter. The last quarter of it is pretty interesting because he kind of wraps up everything to lead into the US part. I guess if you really want to just skip around, probably go to that or just read the introduction in chapter one. Mm-hmm. And then you can probably pick and choose what you want, because the book isn't like, it kind of follows a narrative flow, but you can probably just kind of piecemeal, like, you know, I feel like reading about this part, or why did, you know, Britain conquer the world essentially? Like, how did they do that compared to the Dutch?
That's interesting. I did not expect the second chapter to be both the Dutch and the British. I sort of expected each chapter from chapter one to be like chapter two, the Genovese, chapter three, the Dutch, chapter four, the British, chapter five, the US, chapter six, But I take it that chapter three was both the Dutch and the British?
Chapter three was more of the British system. Just
really?
Yeah. And the kind of the, okay, let's put our theory to the test and let's look at pretty much comparison between Dutch and British and why The Dutch were pretty much in a really prime position to kind of be the, like, the new seat, like, further on, and then the British just took over, and, like, why did that happen?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Spoilers, okay. Is because they just went bankrupt.
Yeah, tulips.
Tulips, yo. Tulips, and be like, hey, we're gonna let you guys borrow money from us. Oh, you're not gonna pay us back? What? The amount of times that has happened, I'm just like, Jesus Christ, you guys.
Yeah, yeah. Be willing to walk away.
Yeah. Because pretty much the Dutch had a lot of capital in speculative and just investing in other ventures, and then those just failed, and then they just never got their money. It was just compounded by, and then you know, Britain had a better naval force,
yeah,
and just was able to just do everything a lot quicker and compared to the Dutch company. So,
Well, so what do we have up for next month?
All right, so to make things confusing, in September, we're doing October, The Story of Russian Revolution by China Melville. Hopefully I pronounced his last name right. And this should be interesting because probably some folks from the Rasputin book that we read earlier probably will show up. So I like reading about the Russian Revolution and just Russia in general during this time because it's very, to me, it's interesting. When they transition from a monarchy to a pseudo monarchy / parliament sorta to then the Civil War happens, which I didn't really don't know much about, so I'm hoping this book will kind of talk a bit about that.
I would think so. I mean, do you think it's just going to be like, yeah, here's all of the history of the revolution, and bye?
I hope not. I guess we'll see.
We will see. Or maybe it will be hella dance, and we'll fail again.
I hope not.
If we do, you're at least going to get probably about an hour of content of us talking about how we failed and what we at least learned along the way.
Yes, and also that space colonization might be the future. Who knows?
It's definitely the future. It's just a question of whether it's going to be utopic or like us madly scrambling to escape the last vestiges of what once was our home.
What a great note to end on. Anyway, remember, books are
good.
Actually.